So if we start with this sense that this is me, that's where we mostly start. In many cases, we come to spiritual practice, contemplative practice, religious practice, because there's some kind of suffering. And the suffering we experience, or the experience we have, is very, very often, this is almost the definition of non-awakened or practice colored by suffering, ignorance, non-wisdom, avidya, lack of knowledge, is that we think we're alone, we think we're isolated, we interpret all of our experience through the lens of this is me. And when we deal in relationship, which of course almost everything we do is in relationship to others, we engage in that relationship from the perspective of a self. And in ways that are good, right? It's necessary to do so. We wouldn't have falling in love if there wasn't different people. We wouldn't have, you know, argument, but we also wouldn't have creativity and agreement, collaboration. All of the things that make relationship rich are defined at some basic level by the presence of difference, self and other. And this is, in a way, we'll mark tonight kind of a developmental sequence. One of the first things that happens very, very early in infancy is that the infant realizes that they are not the same being as mother, for instance. And that differentiation is both painful and necessary, beautiful, awkward. And the sense of self builds over time as we do that. Self and other is at the heart of awareness practice. We have words for things because they are not ourself in a certain way. We can name things out in the world. We name people. We recognize people. And so then this quality of the qualities that are relational by nature, like empathy and compassion, but also, you know, liking, disliking, fondness, love, care, and all of its varieties, are feelings or states of being that arise in this body's stream of experience in relation to others, in relation to these beings that show up in our lives and come in and out of the room in inexplicable ways sometimes, who are not us. And so much of our psychology and so much of what we might try to disentangle or work with if we went to some kinds of therapy, for instance, would be to figure out, you know, what's mine and what's not mine. When my sweetheart comes in the room and I have a feeling, is it my feeling? Is it their feeling? Is it our feeling? Am I so confused that I don't know whose feeling it is? That's part of what gets in the way of clear relationship. But of course, too much differentiation and there's not meeting. And so then the meditation, in a way, is first there's myself, then there's this opening to see another, and there's self and other, and all the complexity and feeling that comes with that. In that, there's closeness and distance, recognition, non-recognition, the feeling of comfort, often through similarity, or discomfort, often through difference. But there's also the dynamicness or creativity that happens when difference is just right, not too much, not too little. There's fear sometimes when there's a lot of difference, but also when there's a lot of sameness. That whole realm of complexity appears in our own life stream when the other appears. In some ways, maybe most of religion and existence is about dealing with the other. The individual other that you might have a relationship with for some part of your life, the beloved, the child, the parent, what we call family, the bigger other, other people, other beings, other cultures, other communities. And in some traditions, the great other that you might call God, goddess. And of course, in some of the mystical traditions, God is a kind of absolute other, not the same as myself, in a profound way, the creator or the one into whom everything dissolves. In other traditions, God is not different from myself at all, not separate at all. The thing I think of as myself is just enfolded in this whole. In other traditions, there's not an absolute other at all, but just the perception of ongoing, flowing relationship all the time unfolding. So, starting from self, other appears. When there is other, there's this whole web of feeling and identity. And there's seeing the other. There's opening to, in some way, the experience of the other through empathy, through compassion, through clear seeing, connecting with, like, oh, this is this person's experience. It's like this for them. At the heart of wisdom practice is not assuming that their experience is like mine, but really being curious. What's your experience like? You who's different from me, whether a little or a lot. And this is one of the beautiful gestures we can make, is to not assume anything particular about someone's experience, but to ask them or to be open, to be receptive to who they are, what they're doing. So seeing the other. And when we see the other, we get both sameness and difference. We see the ways that there are some things that seem similar or seem universal. I'm not going to propose that they are universal because I don't actually know. And in a way, you know, going with the earliest Buddhist texts, one would have to be as enlightened as the Buddha to really know what's universal and what's not, because only then would you have the power or the force to actually understand everything about the universe. Omniscience is what that's called, right? Knowing everything. Since I don't have that, I think that some things are shared by a lot of folks, but I don't know. So then there's just a feeling. I see someone and I'm like, oh, I think we share some things, like pain. Not liking some experiences and liking others, so the presence of pain and the absence of pain, pleasure in existence. I think that lots of beings know something about that. So in self and other, I see some things that look relatable or similar. And then I see the things that are different, that are quite different, that I don't know, don't understand about the other. And we abstract from the singular other. In the meditation, we use like a good friend, someone like, I think I know them. And I still, you know, I'm similar in some ways, different in some ways, but I use the friend because the feeling of seeing them, I could really feel it. Like, oh, I can really see this person because I know something about them. But then we do this sort of magical gesture or impersonal gesture of blowing the awareness out to the whole world. Be like, oh, all beings. And then I really have to generalize and I say, oh, all beings. What do all beings have? Right? They have like birth and death. And I think they have like pain and sorrow and loss. But they also seem to have pleasure and culture and joy and music and families and desires and longings and creativity and ambition in all these different ways. And then the last step, this is really the sequence we did in the meditation, and it's a reflection leading to this thing we call the bodhisattva, vow or intention. The step from seeing the other and seeing the vast others, all beings other, is this recognition that my actions, whether subtle or gross, have an effect in the world. They ripple outward, right? Things I say, things I do, things I think, all affect the world. Sometimes in really strong, direct ways, sometimes in really subtle ways. And this is the piece that's really the hinge. And it's an important hinge in Buddhist practice. And this is the teaching on karma. Karma means action. That there's one who does the action, and there is something that is the recipient of an action. Actions all have effects. So, then the question that leads to the reflection on intention is, if all of my actions always have an effect, and here's other beings, individual other beings and vast numbers of other beings, how must I act? How should I act? Not in a top-down, like, should way. There's no, again, especially if you take an external deity out of the picture. If you have an external deity you like, you just sort of temporarily take them out, but you can, you know, you can include them in the whole web of things. Your actions still have an effect, even if there's someone else looking over your shoulder kindly. But, or not, I mean, whatever tradition you're in, you know. I like my gods to be kind. They're not always. But if you accept this, that there's yourself, there's others, and there's your actions that affect others, then what must I do has to arise in some way, right? Because you have choices. This is like, oh, I get to choose my actions somehow, in some tiny way. Day by day, I choose my words. It's one of the hugest things we do that either can help or hurt. Are my words helping in this moment? Right? I hope, in this very exact moment, I hope so. I really hope they're not hurting. And I say hope because I don't always know, right? I make mistakes, or my education isn't complete enough, or the conditions are such that it's not the right moment for this, or whatever it is. All of these things are present and possible in the relational field. So it's never like just a black and white, like, oh yeah, you know, that was a good action, that was a harmful action. But still, the impulse is like, oh, you know, what could I, what must I do, or what can I do? One of the core reflections in many kinds of Buddhism, especially the Mahayana traditions that really work with this ideal of the Bodhisattva. A Bodhisattva is a being devoted to awakening. Is a reflection on the universality of suffering. And again, I'm cautious about saying that things are universal because the world being what it is right now, and the meeting of very different cultures, and such a harsh power imbalance in the world right now, it's appropriate to not assume universals about others. Many of us are practicing being very careful around assuming universals, because asserting that some things are universal has been a very prominent tactic among the, let's say, colonial power groups. Those who are in power and comfortable have felt at ease saying, you know, some aspect of my experience is universal to all you other people that I have power over. And so in an effort, exactly, right, not to do that, I have to break with Buddhist orthodoxy and say, like, suffering seems to be universal. But we'll say, but exactly what kind of suffering it is, I can't say. And you have to ask people, what's your suffering like? a good question when you meet somebody at a party. Especially a funeral, right? What's your suffering like? I met a parent friend today who has a toddler also. We were walking around the little farm. Our kids were feeding celery to the sheep. And she said to me, "You know this thing where you're in a situation and there's no way out and it's intensely hard and you just can't make it easier and it seems like it's never gonna stop. I had to correct her on that. She's like, "It's never gonna stop." And I'm like, "It changes." I was like, but before we got to that part, I was like, "Yeah, I know that." "You mean existence?" And she was like, "This is why I like hanging out with you." You know. I was like, "Yeah." She's like, "Because you like existential angst." And I said, "I just don't like being in denial about existential angst." So then the intention could arise. How could my actions help the most and hurt the least in this world? And so this archetype or energy or figure or image or proposal called bodhisattva, this is a type of being. This is something that you can be or are already or have been for eons, I don't know. Or could decide in a moment to be. And the thing that makes one a bodhisattva in some of the traditions is a wish or an intention. And that intention is to save or liberate from the condition of suffering everyone, all beings everywhere. Right? Could I live my life such as to actually change others' experience from suffering to freedom, from suffering to non-suffering, in an absolute kind of way? One of the great things about this wish is that it's absurd and impossible. Right? Other beings keep appearing, and they seem to suffer almost immediately. So it's kind of, so if you think of it as a sort of, you know, global kind of whack-a-mole situation, you know, you deal with somebody's suffering and they subside into bliss, and then somebody else pops up. You're like, "Wait, you're suffering," and you deal with that, and you know, 10,000 people pop up with a certain systemic suffering, you fix everything, and they all settle into the earth of bliss and ease and go about their lives. If you thought it was that, right, that's impossible to finish. It's endless. But it still shows up then as this amazing goal. Could I free everyone? And one of the ways that it shows up in the early Mahayana, this is like first or second century BCE through like the, you know, fourth or fifth or so, and then it really gets rooted and becomes all sorts of things like Tantra. But in its early phase, it's marked by things like the intention to become a fully enlightened Buddha as fast as possible, because only with that kind of liberation and power in yourself would you be able to free that many beings. Right? Like, if I just try to do my action in the world and fix things, I can liberate maybe a few beings from some bits of suffering. But look what the Buddha did. Whether you think of it as a historical figure or an archetype, here's this religion that's been around for 2,600 years, and millions of people devoted to liberation in this way who have changed their actions, who have changed the actions of entire countries, who have changed the course of the history of many, many countries by being devoted to wise action and liberation. And among those people who have done who have made such a huge impact on the world. This is what it means when something is a great religion. It means like gazillions of beings have hooked into it and made a big impact on the world, hopefully for good. But of course, mixed. But like, look what happened when this one being awoke in this way and taught and started an organization and spread something in this way. And you could think that about any of the great systems, both religious and secular systems. Some of the great scientists did the same thing, you know. Saint Copernicus, who blew the world up. How many people now are living in a certain liberation because of what that scientist did? The liberation called, I understand the globe and its place in the physical universe. That's huge. Like, billions of people shifted from one vision of what existence was to another. And we could have a discussion about whether that's a good thing, like the change from a sort of flat earth mythic heaven above, hell below worldview into a sphere revolving around a fiery sphere with lots of other spheres and a ginormous swirling mass of stuff, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I think a lot of us would argue that on balance, it's correct enough to reduce suffering or to be useful. So like when one person being has such a huge impact, there's the possibility that a lot of beings could be freed. So these early sages, they were like, well, okay, you know, if you have the most power, the most reach, the most influence by becoming a Buddha, then that's what I'm going to do. And it's like, oh, here's the equation. I see suffering in myself. I see suffering in others. I get that that suffering in others is pretty universal. I don't like suffering in myself. Other beings don't seem to like suffering in themselves. My actions matter. What can I do to help? And if what can I do to help means how could I become more powerful in my helping capacity? And so then it means a couple things, right? It also means that the more powerful I get, the more powerful my wise action and ethics and all of that has to be, because it's possible to be really powerful and forget the empathic seed of the whole project. It's partly why I love the particular Buddhist tradition that I am rooted in, the Theravada, because it held on tight to literal ethical precepts in a way that some of the other traditions abstracted in ways that may not have been as helpful, perhaps. So then what we come to is that there's this mysterious, vast impulse that can arise in practitioners when self and other really is seen clearly, which is that my life's energy like amplifies and spreads out in all directions with the wish to help. How can I serve well-being in as vast a way as possible? So this is this one of these core wishes or impulses behind what's called a bodhisattva. Bodhisattvas vow to save all beings. Bodhisattvas vow to become fully awakened themselves in order to save all beings. So then the last thing I wanted to touch back into then, that's sort of the vast direction that it goes. But if we rewind back to this basic sense of self and other that it starts with, we get this interesting rub. There's a tension in here in relation to action, particularly when action seems bound by finite resources, finite time and space. So, in a very simple way, this is your one life. These are the resources you have access to. This is how much time you have. And you are not yet a fully enlightened Buddha, as far as I know. Hard to say. If you are, thank you for being here. But that means that in a very practical sense, we could give our attention to inner healing, like working on becoming that Buddha in order to free beings. Or we could take whatever bit of clarity we have and turn it outward right away, because beings are suffering now and need help now. But I hope you get that it's not obvious what to do with that. So then we get to say, oh, there's a spectrum of ways to engage in the action of bodhisattva cultivation. One, I'm going to put the spectrum in this plane to say, like, this is the self and that's the other sort of plane in a frontal kind of way. At one end of the spectrum is practicing almost entirely for one's own liberation, whatever one's own means. We're going to leave not self for another night, but there's the perception of myself. Here I am, practicing for my own liberation, dealing with my story, my defilements, my doubts and fears and anxieties in order to clarify this heart for me to suffer less, because I know that if I can suffer less, I will be of more help. But I need a lot of help myself right now. And in a practical sense, like the deep extreme of that might be something like, you know, folks who spend their lives in like solitary retreat practice. Just in a concrete sense of their not being in physical relationship with others, their actions are, might be seen as being directed inward. But of course, even if that's your practice, fully inward, lots of energy directing inward toward your own healing, there could still be that bodhisattva intention just as clear. I'm trying to become as awakened as possible in order to serve. But right at this moment, parentheses, time is an illusion, right at this moment, I have to focus here. This is what I must do. So then at one pole of the spectrum is a deep inward focus. At the other end of the spectrum is, I'm doing okay, I have some resources, yes, I want to awaken, but I am so called to serve in a material, external way that I'm devoting my time and resources to uplifting those who need help now. I'm not going on retreat, I'm not becoming a monastic, I'm fully engaging in uplifting others, in as with as much of my time and energy as I can. And again, that pole is also bodhisattva practice. It also contains the, I need to be more and more awake to do this well. It also contains the seed of oneself in it, especially if in serving all beings, I remember that I'm one of them, which is a good reminder. Right? May all beings be well. That includes me. Right? It's one of the great mistakes to wish well on the entire universe and forget that you're part of it. Right? So call it the great disembodiment. Right? But of course, almost no one lives at those extreme poles. And so then there's a spectrum of action in between. How much of my, and again, we can be really concrete with this, how much of my time and energy is going towards self-healing, self-awakening, inward practice? And how much of my action is caretaking and uplifting of others? It's a very strong urge in, I'll call it, modern convert Buddhism in the West, to really try to uplift the social action side of that spectrum. Partly because Buddhism has been so monastic in the past and has had a strong focus on the inward, And when Buddhism was transmitted to the West, primarily the inward parts of it were transmitted. So, for instance, the big community rituals and celebrations and, you know, lots of chanting followed by a potluck kind of practice was not the primary thing that was brought over in the 60s and 70s throughout the 20th century from Asia, South Asia, Southeast Asia, the various Buddhist heritage countries to Europe and America. The main thing that was brought over was meditation. You know, likewise in yoga, the main thing that came over was you know, personal posture work. So the inward side of that spectrum has been really emphasized. But the religion contains as well the other. And all this, there's a beautiful movement right now to uplift that side of things, to encourage the activists to work in the world. And the pendulum swings back and forth, right? I've been in some situations where there's almost such an emphasis on external action that there's a denigration of going internal, right? That it's self-absorbed or narcissistic or privileged. It is a privilege. It's a tremendous privilege to be able to take time only for oneself. And that privilege has costs, and that cost needs to be accounted for. But throughout that spectrum of action, internal and external, and the tension between them, how much do I give to myself, how much do I serve, go back and forth in different stages of my life, I do more one than the other, which is appropriate. Throughout all of that, we can see that there's a core quality of care or kindness, right? The wish for freedom from suffering. And when I'm fully in the inward side, that care manifests as, you know, as loving kindness and compassion and fervency and practice directed toward my own liberation. When it manifests outward, it manifests as compassion, empathy for others, care for others, kindness, teaching, tending the communal field, the relational field. So then just a little reflection to close, and then we'll talk together. In the meditation, we came to this point of like, here's yourself, here's others, here's all the others, here's suffering in action. What do you want? What do you want to do? And intention in this way, and in the bodhisattva way, this isn't intention like, I want to devote the next 5 years to working on this issue. That's a good intention, whatever, if it's a good issue, whatever. But like, it's a smaller intention. The intention that the bodhisattva vow points to is like, and we might not have words. If you have words for what yours is, that's incredible. Say those words every day for a long time. But often there's a process of finding this. The bodhisattva vow, or this depth of intention, is the kind of intention that it says, like, if you really connect with it, it will sustain you for millions of lifetimes. It's said that the Buddha, Gautama, in our age, the Buddha of our age, it's called, 2,600 years ago, in what's now Bihar, India, or the border of between India and Nepal, this person who walked around and taught, etc. In the Mahayana tradition, it's said that a vast cosmic eon ago, millions of lifetimes ago, during the era of the previous Buddha, because Buddhas keep showing up, right, kind of cyclically. And so in the previous one, our Buddha was a person who met that Buddha. And there's many different stories, but one of them is that our Buddha, in the presence of that previous Buddha, said or thought or felt, right? I vow to become to not just awaken my individual self, but to become a fully awakened Buddha in order to serve all beings. And that earlier Buddha recognized our Buddha and said, you will become that. And this is called the prediction. And so then for the next millions of lifetimes, our Buddha worked with that one core intention to become fully awake, working on the great perfections of generosity and kindness and wisdom and patience, etc., cultivating them over and over and over in millions of different circumstances until the karma of that wish was ripened and all the conditions were set for that final awakening to happen. And that final awakening wasn't a disappearance, but it was actually the explosion of that wish into a kind of action reality that is still here in this room. Like, I couldn't give this talk if he hadn't done that. Right? This is a talk from within a lineage. And lineage is complex right now. Maybe it always has been, but like, I couldn't make this up. Therefore, that wish that mythically, or however you understand it, was made millions of lifetimes ago is still bearing fruit. So when we talk about intention in this way, it's kind of like, how would you get in touch with the intention that you could have in your own life stream, whatever it is, that would have that kind of effect, that would like set the bar for the next cosmic eon of existence that you would participate in? So take a moment and just come up with that. Right.
Goal setting.
A goal setting, right. You know, this is a coaching talk, right? It's just like, there's next week, there's next year, and then there's the next cosmic eon. No, seriously. So here's a tiny practice for that we'll do. It takes like just a minute, and then we'll discuss together. But in a way, bodhisattva practice has something to do with making a relationship with vastness. There's something about huge spans of time and space that's embedded in the bodhisattva vow. I'm going to save all beings. That's ridiculous. Like, think about how big space is and full of beings. And then I'm going to save all beings, which means through time, like being reincarnated in gazillions of ways or ecosystems folding and unfolding over time. And so here's a tiny reflection. Sit in whatever way, be comfortable in whatever way. You can feel yourself as an individual, whatever that means, but you might say the words, me. Or you could whisper to yourself your own name, you know. Just think the words of your name and let it kind of wash through your body. Like, this is me. Check it out. And then, without making too big a deal of it, just relax a tiny bit and allow all of time and space to be present in your awareness. It means you don't have to think about anything particular, but you could just think of the word like all. And know that it means the whole physical universe, the whole temporal universe, everything that's ever been or will be. And as you hold the sense of yourself and everything, just making a space, in in which you might understand that the seed of action, intention is planting a seed. A seed is a small thing that flowers in vast ways. What if yourself, this tiny speck that I call me, amid this vast field called everything, what if the me is the seed? And that intention is just the path of cultivation. How will this seed grow? How big could this seed grow? And how much of this whole could it touch with care, kindness? Where that vow or intention could arise as a feeling, as an intuition way deeper than words. Myself and the all, myself as a seed and an unfolding process. We'll let it go. Come back to the limited. A room of bodhisattvas. Any reflections? What happens for you when you think in this way? What turns in this realm? Any reflections or questions? Yeah.
So the framework of the seed is helpful for me, and it sort of closed a loop on something that I was going to ask about, which was, it seemed like you were talking a lot about this this differentiation between self and everything.
Yeah.
And I also try and hold this idea that maybe that's not what it is. And so mm-hmm. tonight felt like, oh, self, everything, mm-hmm. in a way where a couple of weeks ago it was like self and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I guess that's fine, but the seed, I thought, was brought that back together for me. Because
right.
I thought of the seed as an element of an ecosystem.
Yeah.
So I can be the self that's a seed that's a part of an ecosystem that I'm within.
Yeah.
Then that resonated for me. I don't know.
Yes. Yes. That is, of course, exactly the point, is that those two things, right? And we talked about that a couple of weeks ago. We'll go there, and next week or the week after or whenever we get there, because I've said it before, or who knows if you know, but the punchline of the whole bodhisattva vow is that everything is empty of self-existence. So I said this a couple weeks ago. I was like, do you get that? And someone was like, no. Like, right. You know, like, oh, because, and we'll get there, right? recognizing that everything is absolutely interwoven with the whole and can't be differentiated, if you recognize that in an absolute kind of way, that's awakening. Like, that is the end of suffering on an individual level. So that weaves in, it becomes very mysterious. You get these texts that say, you know, bodhisattvas vow to save all beings. A bodhisattva who thinks that there is such a thing as beings to be saved is not a bodhisattva.
Right.
That's the Diamond Sutra. Maybe we'll do some chat about the Diamond Sutra at some point. Gorgeous. Partly those texts and those vows are meant to kind of just blow your mind, right? They talk about like vast space, vast time, and what the teacher says in those texts, what the Buddha says is, a bodhisattva is one who is not afraid when hearing this teaching. And there's some way that like, oh, part of what makes it possible to make that vow is actually that enough healing or enough space has opened up in myself that I can actually conceive of others in a clearer way without kind of wilting under the immenseness of it all. You know, and that's in a certain way a trauma piece, we could say. Like, part of what happens when I'm so wounded is I can't really see others clearly. And I certainly can't see lots of others clearly. The self story is too constricted by harm done. As that healing happens, it opens outward bit by bit. You know, it's like, oh, from a lifetime of loneliness, a bunch of healing happens and I get one friend. And it's like, you know, I've seen this happen. And then like, you know, oh, I get involved in one thing. I start helping out in this place. I do something. And the healing process kind of bumps it open another layer. You know? And then eventually there's, you know, or if my impulse is drawn in that direction, maybe I'm drawn to these kinds of teachings. And eventually someone says, oh, okay, now that you can rest at ease in yourself a little bit, now remember everything. Now connect with everything. And some part of you is like, whoa. And another part's like, yep. Everythingness. I can hang out with that. And that's this, you know, oh, the bodhisattva is one who's not afraid when considering the everythingness. So, yeah. Yeah, it was never separate, but the vow is to save others, which includes yourself, but still there wouldn't be a vow if there was no separation, right? Which means that the vow arises from within non-enlightenment, right? The vow is a condition of suffering. You don't need to vow to be liberated if you're already liberated.
Right.
So the vow is actually an expression of the maturing of the perception of suffering. If you perceive suffering in enough detail, it will turn into empathy and compassion. And so one teacher, not a direct teacher of mine, but a peer of my teacher's. At one point, his friends said, like, what's your practice about mostly right now? And he said, I really want to understand suffering better. And so, that's a direction. Other thoughts? Yeah.
This is really deep stuff.
It's my job.
So, what I thought about is, you know, first I was thinking Crosby, Stills, Nash, you know, we're Stardust. But then you know, in what is it that differentiates us as human beings from other species? It's that we reflect on what's the purpose of our life. But that when we do it, in order to really hold that, it can't be like what my Jewish mother told me was school and the kids and this and that. Has to be, all that conditioning has to be, we do the Buddhist practices to create the conditions so that there is the emptiness, so that there's the space to really love ourselves and understand ourselves and come to know ourselves and to see that whatever it is within us as us, and it might not be, or example, in my case, might not be me being a trainer of 200 people and changing the world through getting them to be more aware of children. It might just be my understanding how to listen to one person. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really beautiful because whatever I am, it's very different from what you are. And it's like, the practices create the conditions so that that gets revealed to us, and it makes me more sensitive so that I start to feel out of alignment when I don't. It's not because I want to meditate. I didn't really want to meditate tonight. But it's like I have such a headache, and it's like I felt out of alignment. Mm. And then I did, and then I feel so good. And it's like, I don't know.
Yeah.
So this is
totally. And really beautifully said, you know, that like there's this part of the work that's kind of a clearing out and an emptying so that more recognition, more love, more clarity, you know, comes through for myself, through others, through my actions. It weaves back and forth in my internal practice, my external practice. You know. And of course, spoken like one who's been practicing within the stream of the devotional emphasis for a long time, that like this thing that we could say, oh, emptiness, in Buddhist language, in other traditions, would just be called love. It's not different, you know. So, you know, beautifully woven in.
The reason why it's empty is because it's not my choice. It's like I might want it, but I have to get out of the way.
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah.
I can't be here if I'm in what my concepts are, how to get here, or my fears on how I'm going to get there. I have to be just here. Or I know I can't see it.
Yeah.
You got it. This whole thing. Yeah. Nice.
So we are kind of right now getting a reminder that Buddhist cultures and societies are not fundamentally and inherently peaceful ones.
Yep.
And there's part of me that feels like that, you know, if, how does that complicate and in some ways kind of undermine the idea that focusing inward and achieving enlightenment is actually going to save all beings. Like, I feel it kind of does. You know, if it is true that suffering is not actually fundamentally reduced in a really observable way in places where there are more practitioners,
right?
What does that mean for that inward end of the spectrum?
Absolutely, right? It's a huge question, you know. I imagine this opens into reflections on a lot of levels, you know. One would be something like, you know, if we actually got to look in detail at like predominantly Buddhist societies over the last, you know, few thousand years, 2,600 years, and that were relatively stable and steeped in these teachings and practices. What were they like overall? Or what are they like overall? And not in a specific, like, of course there were bad things that happened, but like, if somehow you could actually get the kind of, the full spread of data on like, how content is this population? You know, what are the states of mind like that people are resting in? What percentage of people really are not suffering in that way, in this kind of existential way. And I don't know, of course, like I don't have that data. What I know is that some cultures have adored this tradition and its inwardness so deeply that they've preserved it, not just in texts and theory, but in the bodies of millions and millions of people who devoted their whole lives to monastic practice. So poverty and celibacy and simplicity and tons of retreat. And not all of those people got purified. Like, it's totally possible to be a bad monk. You know? And by bad, I would just mean unethical. But it's also possible to be a monk who doesn't make that much progress toward liberation, which isn't bad, it's just your karma. I think I was one of those. Whatever. But, like, it is something that there have been cultures where a lot of resource has gone to maintaining this thing. And that's interesting in itself, even if those cultures have been, you know, kind of human and, like, had all sorts of defilements and faults. So sometimes people separate the Dharma itself from the actions of institutions that perpetuate it. That's one maneuver, right? It has its dangers. You could be like, well, the Dharma is pure, but, you know, the monastic institution is flawed. Well, of course the monastic institution is flawed. But, of course, what is the Dharma? Is it a particular thing that was preserved in texts? Well, that's flawed, you know? Was it the oral tradition preserved by a bunch of monastics? Well, that's flawed, you know? The only thing that we could say that the Dharma is some sort of absolute, like, well, it's the truth of everything. And then we're not talking about countries and actions and people anymore. So Buddhists are people, right? And by definition, Buddhists are unenlightened people. Like, you wouldn't need to do it if you were done. People who live in New York are no longer traveling to New York, right? And they are categorically different from people traveling to New York. They are in New York. They will tell you that. But part of what's, you know, so there's that about, like, it's clear to me that these practices do something that millions of people have said is valuable, even if the evidence is that the world has not been saved. And part of what's also in your question is something like, or I wonder if there is something like, part of something that I hear in it that might be just me, but I could hear something like, what can I believe in? Like what is there in the world that's strong enough or clear enough or good enough that I could actually believe in it, that this could lead to real, you know, ending of suffering? Because the evidence is poor, frankly, you know, in a certain way. Stephen Pinker will tell you otherwise. He says things are getting better. The data is mixed on better and worse. But this is a religion. And it's a religion partly because it proposes something that's not immediately verifiable by experience. In other words, it says radical liberation from suffering is possible. You don't know very many people who have attained that. But here's this ancient, huge tradition that says it's possible. Does that inspire you? And if it does, then that's something called faith. And the core element of faith in the Buddhist system in the early tradition that I'm mostly speaking from, all this Mahayana stuff is early to mid-tradition, but, like, is faith in the enlightenment of the Buddha. In other words, do you actually say, yes, I believe that this person got fully liberated? And it's not always that easy to say. Like, that's why it's a faith. It's not a... You can't prove it. And the world looks like a mess. So maybe before there's even the intention, may I save all beings, there's a whole process to even get to the feeling that it could even be possible for anyone to be liberated or saved. And that's a whole process, you know, that you may believe in or not, I think. And I think it's okay not to, or to, on a belief level, and still find value in, you know, aspects of the path. Like, who knows about liberation or beings or whatever, but I know that when I sit and I rest into myself, it shifts in the direction of what feels like rightness or goodness. And that's enough to keep practicing with. And in a way, like, you have to have faith in anything that's enough to keep you practicing is good faith in a system like this. And then the proposal would just be, if doing the practice a little bit helps this much, what might be possible if I did it a lot? Something like that. So no good answer to that.
I'll take it.
You ask the best difficult questions, you know. And really, you know, this at least might go to travel around the world. And you'll just have to, like, tweet me really good questions. Cause, you know, yeah? Awesome. I'll read them here. All right. So thanks for being here. Blessings. Totally a pleasure. Your offerings of your resources help the whole thing to keep going. Thank you for your generosity. Money and things in the little wooden box or at the desk. And thanks for patience with my sub last night. Last week. Ella said it went great. I was really happy that she could come and offer her wisdom here. Wonderful practitioner. Thanks for being here. Those who were. I gave a talk down at Insight Meditation South Bay on concentration in the nervous system. So it's up on my website if you want to hear it. So see you again, and many blessings.
Thanks, Sean.
Yeah.